Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
President Obama, from his news conference last night on AIG.
I understand that AIG is not a bank. It's an insurance company. If it were a bank and it had effectively collapsed, then the FDIC could step in, as it does with a whole host of banks, as it did with IndyMac, and in a structured way renegotiate contracts, get rid of bad assets, strengthen capital requirements, resell it on the private marketplace.
All right. The president flashing a little intensity there on the AIG bonuses, but also the larger underlying culture that produced them. And that's where my next guest comes in. Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone has written maybe the best explanation yet of how we got into the financial crisis. It's opinionated. It's angry. Its expletives are not deleted, but it goes layers and layers deep. It also has Matt Taibbi's Dirty Dozen, the dozen corporate execs and government officials who should take most of the blame. And we're going to invite you to go there with us and get out your brackets for a little March economy madness, because we have a webpage for this segment as we ask, who would you put in your final four as the game-changing villains who sank the economy? Go and nominate your final four at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show as we welcome Matt Taibbi back to the program. Hi, Matt. Thanks for coming on with us for this.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And you've got Alan Greenspan in your Dirty Dozen and Phil Graham and Sandy Weill and Henry Paulson and others who we'll get to. But I think the biggest villain in your piece is not a household name. Joe Cassano, the head of AIG's financial products division from 2001 to 2008. And I thought we might take a few minutes at the top here to talk a little bit about Joe Cassano. You nickname him the arsonist. Who is Joe Cassano?
We called him the patient zero of the financial crisis, because he was the head of a tiny division within AIG called AIG FP Financial Products. And they were basically a highly complex little investment bank within the AIG holding company, Aegis. And he was dealing in a type of complex derivative called credit default swaps. Basically, what he was doing was he was helping all these investment banks that were investing in the housing market. He was offering them a kind of insurance, a way to hedge their investments. And basically, they would pay him a small premium every month, and in return, he would promise to pay them off in full if the underlying loans that they were investing in defaulted. But the problem was, because of a loophole in the regulations, he didn't actually have to have any of the money when he offered these guarantees. So he basically wrote about $450 billion or almost $500 billion in guarantees, and he didn't have that money. So when the rent came due, AIG blew up, and that's why the state had to step in.
Wait, he was offering guarantees and he didn't actually have the money. Why does the name Bernie Madoff come to mind?
Well, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme. It's similar to that, except that this was completely, on the surface, it was completely legal. Because of a regulatory loophole, these credit default swaps, nobody has to post any money when you offer these kinds of guarantees. And the only mistake that AIG made is that they went in so far, and they wrote so many of these contracts, that there was just no possible way that they could have upheld their end of the deal if anything went wrong. They were essentially banking that the housing market was never going to collapse,
right,
that it would continue to go up. And, it, you know, of course, that was an unrealistic expectation.
And we can take your phone calls for Matt Taibbi, either on his deep dig into what really happened at AIG, or with your final four for March economy madness, who deserves the most blame for sinking the economy? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We've got Alex from Facebook, by the way, who nominates Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, and change sank the economy to are sinking the economy, he says. Someone else, HJS, writes, Bush, asleep at the wheel, Greenspan, high priest of voodoo finance, Hastert and Gingrich GOP Congress, and Reagan free market Uber Alles. So they're all of one party. We get the Summers and the Clinton and the Rubin from one of the other posters. Who do you think? Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, Cassano at AIG made it so that investors buying credit default protection didn't have to put their own money up front, like in a typical insurance premium. Is that correct?
Well, no, he didn't have to put up the money. He was the one who was selling the protection. So the people who were buying protection from him, they had to pay a premium regularly every month. So AIG was making large amounts of cash on these premium payments that they actually were getting from various companies like Goldman Sachs, which was one of their biggest customers. But Cassano didn't have to post any money.
Right. And his worst move, you say, came in August 2007 when subprime mortgages were already going south. What did Joe Cassano do in August 2007?
Well, one of the things that he did is he stood up at an investor conference and he said, I fail to see, without being flippant, how we could lose even $1 in these transactions. And it turned out that that very month his company was losing about $350 million. So, and months after that, he basically reiterated his position, saying that he didn't think that there could be any losses in his portfolio. Soon after that, AIG had to announce about $11 billion in losses, and Cassano was sort of quietly ushered out the door at that point. But he was retained. He was allowed to keep a $1 million a month salary even after he was forced out of the company, and he even got to get that salary briefly after the bailout.
So was he clueless? Was he arrogant? What? To think that everything was going to be fine and there was no way to lose any money even after the subprime meltdown began?
Well, one of the things you have to remember is that there's a difference between believing that you yourself are going to lose money and believing that AIG or your company is going to lose money. Joe Cassano, out of all of this, made almost $300 million, and he hasn't had to give any of it back. So he's not really a loser in this situation. You know, he didn't really stand anything to lose by continually doubling down on this bet and continuing to collect on all these premiums. If and when he got fired, he would get fired, but he wouldn't have to give any of that money back. This is sort of an indirect consequence of a major change in the whole culture of investment banking, which really began with Salomon Brothers going public, you know, ages ago. You know, now investment bankers, they're not really betting with their own money. They're betting with those of shareholders. And so they're a lot less careful. They know that they're going to make their bonuses and their money no matter what. So the important thing to them is volume, not performance.
Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone with the deep look at what really happened at AIG and the Dirty Dozen, as he calls it, the bankers and brokers responsible for the financial crisis and the officials who let them get away with it. Alan Greenspan, here are all 12. Alan Greenspan, Sandy Weill, Phil Graham, Joe Cassano, Robert Rubin, Jimmy Kane from Bear Stearns, Christopher Cox at the SEC, Mr. Buckpasser, as he's nicknamed here, Angelo Mozzillo, head of Countrywide, John Thain, Henry Paulson for his time at Goldman Sachs mostly, Dick Fuld, the big loser, CEO of Lehman Brothers, Mr. Too Big, Ken Lewis. So there you go. Let's talk about the regulatory piece of this. How are they allowed to get so far down the road into these credit default swaps and these naked credit default swaps, as they were called, which the ones were the most risky ones that you were describing, without the government stopping them?
Well, there was a law passed in the waning days of the Clinton administration. Actually, it was already after George Bush had already been elected, but before he took office. And around Christmas in the year 2000, it was called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It was sponsored by Phil Graham, but it was signed into law by Bill Clinton. And this exempted credit default swaps from being regulated as futures, as commodities, as securities. And it also specifically exempted them from being regulated under state gaming laws. Because, you know, in reality, credit default swaps, and particularly these so-called naked credit default swaps, are really indistinguishable from gambling. What it really is a pair of parties betting on whether or not a third party is going to default on his loan. It's really not any different than betting on whether one team wins or loses a football game. So they were specifically exempted from being regulated by that law. So there was nobody who really had a specific mandate to regulate any of this activity, although in theory, the AIG's regulator, which was the Office of Thrift Supervision, could have stepped in and said, hey, you know, this bet that you're making is irresponsible. But nobody had a specific mandate to watch that activity.
Rob in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hey, Rob, who are you putting in your brackets?
Hi. Well, I would start back in history a ways where the poison seed was planted, the Community Redevelopment Act. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Chris Dodd, and Barney Frank pushing that. If banks didn't agree to stop so-called redlining and give out these free mortgages or actually give people down payments, which poisoned the whole mortgage system, we wouldn't be in this mess. Now, granted, that we wound up in a perfect storm with everybody taking advantage of this mess. But Jimmy and Bill and Barney and Chris, they undermined the whole mortgage system, the whole capitalist concept of mortgages.
And you don't think that AIG and Bear Stearns and these others, all on their own, taking whatever Fannie and Freddie help there was to people in working class America, and deciding that this was going to be the essence of capitalism, that this was going to become 40% of the economy. You think you can blame that on the Community Reinvestment Act?
Yes, underneath it, yes. These Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, they're all opportunists. I mean, they're going to go where the money is. But it started with this undermining. I mean, whatever happened, when my father bought a home after World War II, he had to have 25% down. He had to have a solid job, et cetera, et cetera. This was just all thrown away by that community. And so, of course, eventually.
That's wrong, first of all. I mean, you're completely misinterpreting what the Community Reinvestment Act was. Those regulations about having to have 25% down, those weren't thrown away then. They were thrown away in the 90s through various regulatory changes. And that was, and besides, those loans to minority mortgage holders, it just makes up such a tiny percentage of what we're talking about here. And it's just, I understand the instinct to blame this all on one side or another, but anybody who doesn't look at this crisis and see that it was Republicans and Democrats working hand in hand to push through all these deregulation changes is just being naive.
Rob, thank you for your call. And obviously there are many Democrats and Republicans involved here, and there are some Democrats on your list like Robert Rubin, but you don't go at all in your article after Fannie and Freddie or the Democrats in Congress, and even Andrew Cuomo as HUD secretary, who promoted the idea of widespread subprime mortgages for lower-income Americans, especially people of color. Do they not deserve a mention in your piece?
Well, you know, I've gotten some mail about this, and I understand the instinct to say that it's obvious if you can't afford to buy a 6-bedroom house, you shouldn't be buying a 6-bedroom house. But that's not the reason we had this massive explosion in cheap credit, and that's not the reason that these banks felt empowered to issue so many of these irresponsible mortgages. The reason was that we created the secondary mortgage market. You know, in the old days, if you were going to issue a mortgage, you weren't going to, you know, give a $1 million mortgage to some unemployed meth addict because you didn't want to keep that loan on your books. The reason that all this changed was because you invented things like the CDO and the secondary mortgage market, which made it possible for banks to issue these mortgages and then sell them off to other people and eventually move them off to customers in Saudi Arabia and China and places like that. And you know, it was the fact that the CDOs made it possible to turn, you know, subprime mortgages into AAA rated paper that they could sell to insurance companies and pension funds. You know, obviously people who can't afford houses shouldn't buy them, but that's not the reason we got into this mess. It's a small tangential symptom of the problem.
And if Rob wanted to go in one direction and reach back into the 70s and 80s, Timothy in Nassau is going to go all the way the other way, I think. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi.
So?
I think this isn't a soundbite, but this is something that I think we got to understand. We're a consumer-driven economy. One of the things we know that has happened is that we've shifted income from the middle class since Reagan dramatically up into the top 2% of the population. The top 10 percentile doesn't show much growth. The top 2%, we have the hockey stick growth in income. What that's done is it's redistributed the wealth from the people who sustain the economy to this small percentile that warehouse the money that we all need to use. The economy is like the ocean. It's something that's constantly moving. When it gets deflected into a particularly small group, the entire economy has to fall because the people who spend the money no longer have it. So what did we do? We borrowed. And this was now not only we borrowed, we were encouraged to borrow. People were borrowing on their credit cards, on their homes, on everything in order to sustain a standard of living that couldn't be sustained by the goods and services that they were producing. We redistributed the wealth from the people who were producing the wealth to the people who basically the only thing they did was they had control over how much money they could take from the economy. They didn't do anything. If these people at AIG had made a fortune for AIG, no one would be talking about this now, but they would have done nothing to stimulate the economy or produce growth. They would have repackaged mortgages that had been sold by subsidiaries.
Timothy, I think you get to the heart of something crucial here, but let me follow up with one question. Yes, people were encouraged to borrow beyond their means. We all know about, you know, the credit addiction in the United States, and that is one of the root causes for this crash. And now people are saving, and they say that's a crisis. But what's the relationship between that and the hockey stick curve, as you put it? The fact that some people at the top were getting very, very wealthy. That in and of itself, they would argue, doesn't make middle-class people less well off.
Well, it certainly did, because what happened was is that, as we know what happened, in terms of the distribution of wealth. There's something called the Gini curve. The CIA used it to determine wealth distribution in every country it looks at. It looks at the United States and sees we have a Gini curve of 45. We're on that point, 45 in the Gini curve, which puts us in the same category as Haiti. I mean, all of Europe is in the 20s to 30s. We're way the hell up in distribution, so that the money that we would be spending as the middle class to buy refrigerators, washing machines, cars, to buy homes, to do the things that stimulate the economy broadly. That's why we're giving out $25 a week in paychecks, because we got to stimulate the economy broadly. The things that we do are not being not possible because the wealth has been. I mean, there was a thing in New York Times about 3 years ago. It said that the top 2% of the country controlled 55% of the nation's wealth.
Timothy,
that's outrageous.
I got to go, but I appreciate you. How do you know so much about things like the Gini curve?
I have a doctorate, but I've been studying the economy for about 6 months, just studying, reading Keynes, reading everybody. That's how I've been. I mean, and it's also obvious from the facts. If you look at the facts, this is what's happened to our economy. We've redistributed the wealth up, and until we get it back into the hands of the people who actually spend the money and broadly base it, you're not going to go anyplace.
Timothy, call us again. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone, who wrote about the deep background of what really happened at AIG in his article called The Big Takeover, including the Dirty Dozen, as he identifies them, responsible for crashing the economy. And we're still inviting your nominations. Get out your brackets for March Economy Madness. Who would you put in your final four as having the most responsibility, the most blame for this? And Matt, one of the things in your article right at the beginning was a lot of outrage that you were expressing at Ed Liddy, the current CEO of AIG, for his appearance in Congress last week. Now, Ed Liddy is the guy who was basically brought in by the government to try to fix the problem, so he doesn't get Joe Cassano kind of blame here. But you were outraged that he went before Congress and said this.
You know, we'd like to do it tomorrow. But the practical reality is the marketplace is a pretty crummy place to be right now. You all see that. When the world catches pneumonia, we get it too in spades because we are so large.
So, Matt, why did that make you so angry?
Well, it's just that he's comparing AIG's problems to catching cold. You know, I mean, if if making $500 billion bets with money you didn't have is just like catching cold. I just don't understand that analogy. I mean, he portrays AIG as an innocent victim, whereas in fact they were just irresponsible on a scale probably never seen before in the history of capitalist finance. I mean, they punched a hole in the fabric of the universe that it's going to take us an entire generation to patch, and they did it because they were greedy, because they were willfully ignoring their own accounting, and because they didn't really understand the products that they were selling. And that's not really catching pneumonia. That's irresponsibility is what it is.
And saying, oh, we got caught up in this bigger thing that was going on when they were such a big player and causing what was going on.
Right, exactly.
Mark, in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, both of you, Matt, everything. An explanation of the ratings agency is sort of necessary here. And Matt, I read your article. It was great, but I didn't notice that one of the linchpins in all of this were the bond rating agencies that, in that last guy's call who was trying to blame this on the Community Investment Act, he doesn't speak of the fact that the entire system was corrupted from within inside, because if you didn't get the rating you wanted from one agency, you could go to another one, and they would look for you to do business with, and if one wouldn't get it to you, the other would.
I'm so glad you called in with this, Mark, because I was going to ask Matt this about, too. And Matt, I think another good villain here is the credit rating agencies. I mean, in very plain English, you write about how their overly generous AAA rating for AIG meant, as you put it, the crappiest mortgages could be sold to conservative investors.
Right.
So did they not get how many subprime mortgages were being passed off as AAA in these mortgage security bundles? It was their job to look at the books and understand.
Again, this all gets into the really, really complicated math of what is a collateralized debt obligation. You know, they created these derivative instruments that essentially diced up very risky loans into little pieces, and it's very complex. But what they did is they took a slice of these loans, and they said, we expect that in 9,900 cases out of 1,000, we're going to get X amount of money every month. The ratings agencies accepted the math of these people who invented these collateralized debt obligations, and I don't think they understood the math. Either that, or it's even worse. They, after the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999, when investment banks and commercial banks and insurance companies were allowed to merge, very oftentimes you had companies that were doing these ratings actually working in the same companies that were issuing the securities. So they had a tremendous incentive to put a good rating on very, very risky instruments and securities. And so the whole system got corrupted, and we ended up getting these derivative instruments that were very, very complex and were rated AAA when really they were a lot riskier than that.
Now, before you go, I want to touch one other little piece of this. I don't know if you saw the op-ed. It wasn't really an op-ed, but they used it as an op-ed in the Times today. It was the resignation of an AIG employee who writes, and I'm just going to read it because this is a heartfelt plea. This is a guy who got about $1 million bonus, by the way, and is now watching the government try to claw it back, or at least convince him to give back the bonus, and he says he won't. But in his resignation letter, he writes, I was in no way involved in or responsible for the credit default swap transactions that have hamstrung AIG, nor were more than a handful of the 400 current employees of the AIG Financial Products Division. Most of those responsible have left the company and have conspicuously escaped the public outrage. After 12 months of hard work dismantling the company, during which AIG reassured us many times we would be rewarded in March 2009, We in the financial products unit have been betrayed by AIG and are being unfairly persecuted by elected officials. And I think Regina in Jersey City wants to echo that sentiment. Regina, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. My husband is a mid-level manager there at AIG, working in the IT department. He's been with the company for about 8 years. We both have really conservative financial views, 20% down, have underlived our salaries, set some money aside. And, he's just being so dragged down as an employee of this company. He was unaware of the fact that this British business unit was, involved in the activities that they were involved with. The CEO has held you know, weekly hands-on meetings. Last week's meeting was please stop carrying any AIG logo merchandise that we gave you last year. No umbrellas, no ID badges. There have been death threats. We'll be changing your email addresses. And my husband likes to joke. He goes into the office every day and deletes his spam in the inbox, and now he deletes all the death threats, and then he has to get about the job of doing his work.
Does he really get death threats personally?
He hasn't. I mean, he's just joking about that. But, you know, it's just taken over his psyche. He's having trouble sleeping.
Sounds horrible. What are you guys going to do? You're going to try to, you know, for him to move to another company?
I don't know if that's possible right now. You know, with the economy being where it is today, it's you know, there aren't a whole lot of jobs being created. I think he's just going to stick it out there. But, you know, another guy that he works with has 100% of his retirement savings in AIG stock. You know, I guess he didn't get the WorldCom memo or any of that.
What do you think about that Jake DeSantis resignation letter that was published in the Times that I read from?
I'm right there with him.
Wait a minute, though. I mean, you work for your husband works for the IT department. This guy Jake DeSantis worked for AIG FP. That's an enormous difference.
Enormous difference. But
it is. But I mean, like you said, that all of these people have gone unscathed. You know, no one is going after them, and instead they're going after anyone, you know, who works down on Wall Street or in Jersey City, and they're holding the wrong people accountable for this.
So who are you most angry at, and who is your husband most angry at, Regina?
You know, I guess we just believed in the myth of working hard and, you know, and that the good karma boomerang would come back and reward us someday.
You're disillusioned.
And, yeah, we're just really, you know, we can't believe that these people did this. You know, we used to joke years ago, you know, you needed to put money down for a home, you know, you set some aside and everything. And people used to tell us, oh, you know, bad credit, no credit. Personal bankruptcy in your past, they'll still write a mortgage for you. If your dog needs a loan, it's not a problem. I'm sure we've got a product to sell you. And, you know, people thought we were crazy when we kept saying, no, you know, the whole real estate market is overinflated. Everyone had better be careful. You know, it's a bubble, and when it bursts, who knows what's going to happen. But I don't think either one of us ever saw this coming.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's important to remember that the reason that so many banks were able to do that is because they were hedging their investments with companies like AIG FP.
Clearly understood. Yeah, yeah. Clearly understood. Right. You know, AIG has a reputation for writing you know, policies that no one else would. But obviously, you know, they went way too far.
All right, people, don't blame Regina and her husband in the IT department. Thank you for calling in and sounding off. Good luck to both of you. And Matt, before you go, just how about your reaction to that letter? Because that guy says, look, I didn't work in that division. I didn't do this. I was not responsible for this.
But he in another part in of that division.
Well, he says the credit default swaps division of financial products.
Well, look, that
he says he didn't even know about it.
Yeah, well, I don't believe him. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, that tiny unit made billions and billions of dollars in the last few years, largely on the strength of these credit default swaps. And I'm sure he got some of that money in the last few years and didn't complain about it then. It just seems, you know, in a company that's as small as that, with only 377 employees, for him to say he's not aware of where all that money was coming from sounds pretty disingenuous to me. It's suddenly nobody is responsible for it except Joe Cassano. That's just not realistic to me.
Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone reporter, writes the article in the April 2nd issue, The Big Takeover. And listeners, you can keep going on this. Maybe we'll do a follow-up and kind of keep whittling down your brackets. Who would you put in your final four as the game-changing villains who sank the economy? Participate in this March Economy Madness at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. By the way, Matt, your illustrator wrote in, Victor, saying that Matt's articles in Rolling Stone say he said his writing inspired my imagery, and the imagery on these Dirty Dozen cartoons or illustrations that he made are really kind of very diabolical.
they're hilarious. I've actually never personally spoken to Victor, so maybe you should patch him through after I get off.
Really? Well, he likes your writing. They are filled with hate, colorful hate, the illustrations of your Dirty Dozen. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, New York's proposed Ring of Steel. Are you ready for 1,000 security cameras below Canal Street? This is the last day to comment to the NYPD.